Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by Jonathan Bernstein and Casey B.K. Dominguez to talk about The Making of Presidential Candidates 2020. This book was published in 2019, in the fall of 2019, by Roman and Littlefield. And this is part of a longer series, but I think that Jonathan Bernstein will tell us a little bit more about that. Today I'd like to welcome both Jonathan and Casey to the podcast and ask them to tell us a little bit about themselves and how they came to this particular project. Hi, Casey and Jonathan.
Hello.
Hello. This is a series that goes back. I guess I should introduce myself. Jonathan Bernstein. I am a political scientist, but my day job is that I'm a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. So I came to this. This is a series that goes back, believe, to the 1996 election cycle. And it was Bill Mayer's edited volume, William G. Mayer. And he put it out every 4 years. And he added me on as a co-editor for the 2012 editions. And, you know, it's a premier edited volume of about presidential nominations, the process and everything about presidential nominations. So then it didn't happen in 2016, but we've brought it back. Bill decided not to do it anymore, and Casey and I decided to take it up for this one, and I think it turned out great. So we're happy about it. And Casey, you want to introduce yourself, and then I'll tell get to the next part, or I'm not sure how we do that.
So I'm Casey Dominguez. I'm a professor at the University of San Diego. I teach American politics. I've done research in a variety of areas, beginning with Jonathan and I were both interested in political party networks in the very early days, in the early 2000s, when that was just an idea that people were coming up with before the UCLA, The Party Decides, was written. So we've been talking about these issues for a long time, and I was very excited when he asked me to possibly be a part of editing this volume, and that's how I got involved.
And Jonathan, you said you wanted to talk about the next part.
Well, I said my day job is Bloomberg Opinion, but I should also say that my research has been on party networks and that sort of thing. You know, what some of us are calling the California school of party research. Since I worked with Casey about it a while ago, in fact, I had a chapter in the 2000 edition of this book, which was about networks of party elites and how they played roles in campaigns and then transitioned to the White House. So, you know, I've been involved in this volume for a long time, but now doing it as the co-editor with Casey. And, you know, we brought this thing back in part because I wanted to write a chapter, but in part because it had become, I think, and since I was involved in the last one, I think it's fair that I can say it was a little stale, and we sort of brought it up to date, and it looks much more, I think, and I hope, like, you know, contemporary political science and not like 1990s political science. So I think we were happy with the group of authors. We have, you know, wound up with a strong group of authors, and I think we're happy with how it turned out.
And in terms of sort of saying, as it's more up to date, and not only incorporates contemporary political scientists and authors, but you also are including different areas that were not included in previous volumes. Can you talk a little bit about what were additions to this volume that weren't perhaps in previous iterations of the sort of making of presidential candidate?
Well, yeah, we can start with chapter one right away, which was about women running for president, which, you know, had been a relevant topic for quite some time, but had not been covered, I don't think, in previous editions of the book. So we have a great chapter by Linda Beale, Goren, and Mary McHugh, talking about a 20 nomination contest.
Are there other chapters as well that were more up to date or weren't involved in previous books, versions of the book?
I think it was sort of more open to newer ideas. So, you know, some of it, you know, we have 9 chapters in the book. I think some of them are covering similar topics to what we've had in the past, but I think we were more open to sort of like the essay that Julia Azari did about whether parties are inherently conservative, which I think is a fascinating essay about the institutional incentives of parties to resist change in some ways because they are institutions themselves. And I don't think that kind of sort of conceptual thing had been in previous editions of it. So I was happy to have that in this one. Casey, I don't know if you have any further thoughts on that.
Well, not as compared to previous editions. I'm not quite as familiar as the earlier editions as you are.
And so with this book, The Making of the Presidential Candidates, and with the previous iterations, obviously this is a question about understanding who becomes candidates for the White House. And so previous iterations have the same sort of thrust. But what do we learn from reading through these chapters about the presidential candidates themselves and what's required in terms of making them?
Casey, you want to take a first crack at that?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, when we were originally thinking about the project, we had chapters organized sort of by rules and institutions and then voters. And as it evolved, I think it's a little bit more chronological. We start with candidates, right? Because the process begins with candidates as self-starters. And then we've got a chapter about fundraising, because that's the first thing you do if you want to run for president. And then we've got a chapter about the media and, you know, the really important role that the media plays in helping candidates gain traction, followed by a great discussion of how primary voters get involved. And then the last section, basically the last half of the book, is all about parties as institutions and the different ways that we've got a chapter about the party rules and how the party rules are continuing to evolve in real time. We've got Jonathan's essay about how the party and the media interact to produce, especially candidates like Donald Trump. And then Julia Azari's piece about parties trying to choose a nominee, and if there's a certain conservatism to the way that parties approach choosing their nominee. And then we've got an article about straw polls and the sort of limited historical role of straw polls. And then we've got a wonderful historical piece about the origins of party nominations itself in the around the year 1800. So I think it takes a reader through or student readers through sort of the chronology and the actors and the institutions that affect how candidates become the party nominee.
And in terms of the sort of how candidates become the party nominee, as you note, I did contribute with two of my two co-authors, Linda Beale and Mary McHugh, the question of masculinity and female candidates and understanding the nomination contest. and this sort of ongoing quest for Madam President. But there's so much more to discuss in terms of how we get to a candidate as a nominee for president. And as you note, there's the question of money. There's the question of media. There's the question of obviously the role of the parties. This is something I constantly talk about with my students during nomination contests is what are the parties doing and how are they operating at the state and local level? But I wanted to ask if there were surprises in terms of the research that your authors were doing and when they were turning in their drafts and their chapters to you, what you found that was unexpected or something that you hadn't really thought about in terms of the nomination process itself.
I think for me, the one that was really the biggest surprise was, or at least that got me thinking the most, was Julia Bazzari's case about whether institutional bias towards being conservative. As someone who got into this through studying political parties, what I think that people who study political parties have in common is most of us really like political parties, and we think that we have a bias in favor of them. So we tend to look towards them, towards parties as producing good results if they work properly. And what Julia sort of maintains is, well, yes, but you know, the parties also have this sort of inherently, because they're institutions, they have difficulty sometimes being the generators of change that party actors may want them to be. And I thought that was something that I had not ever thought of before. And I thought was very interesting.
I would say that I had two, I mean, you know, a lot of the book is more like literature review. So there's not necessarily a lot of groundbreaking here. That doesn't mean that it's not useful. There weren't a ton of surprises in the research, but I will say there were two points that I keep going back to, and that I think have updated a little bit how I teach about this. In the chapter on voter choice in presidential primaries by John Sides, Michael Tesler, and Lynn Vavreck, who of course wrote Identity Crisis, and Sides and Vavreck wrote. They've been looking at systematically analyzing how voters have reacted to the presidential campaigns throughout the primary and the general, but including the nomination campaign for several cycles. They had an interesting conclusion in their chapter about how voters make choices in the nomination contest, that groups of voters are going to react differently to the candidates. And there's just no way to know in advance how intra-party sort of demographic groups are going to react to the candidates that emerge out of the sort of candidate soup. And I thought a lot about that as we sort of were looking at all of the 25 candidates who came up in 2019 and 2020 and on the Democratic side, and sort of looking for whether big demographic groups were going to lean one way or the other and how that might affect the race. So I thought that and just sort of the unpredictability of that, you know, were young voters going to take it over the top for Bernie and sort of watching for those kind of demographic shifts in 2020. I thought that was an interesting observation. For everything that we know about how voters behave, you don't know how groups of voters are going to react to particular presidential candidates and campaigns. And that introduces an unpredictability for everything that we know already. And then the other thing that I thought was, again, not surprising, was a really interesting observation and a really useful analysis was in the Bill Mayer's chapter on the changes in the presidential selection process from 1792 to 1824. And he just really systematically goes through, when I teach my students about the early presidential nomination processes, you know, I sort of lump everything before 1824 together as like the you know, King Caucus. And he lays out that it wasn't actually all a congressional caucus. There were several different methods chosen. And I thought that's really interesting detail to be able to offer students and to understand at a different level of complexity. And then he does a really excellent analysis of how the Electoral College by 1824 became a rubber stamp, sort of how many states were using a system of selecting the state's electors, and this is for the general election, you know, for the general election, not for the primaries, but for selecting the electors in accordance with the vote of the people in that state, how that general ticket system came to be adopted. And he's got a really systematic analysis of that. And I think that really helps me flesh out that story for my students. So again, you know, there's a lot of great analysis in the book, but those were two observations that I thought were really insightful.
And so I wanted to take each of you, if you don't mind, through your own contributions to the book itself. And Casey, your chapter focused specifically on money and fundraising. So could you provide, or could you talk a little bit about what you were looking for in terms of understanding the role of this within the nomination process?
Sure. So, you know, the book is aimed at, undergrad people who want to understand the presidential nomination process. And honestly, that's going to come mostly in undergraduate classes. And so I wanted to sort of hook students on the question that they start being interested in, which is, why does all this cost so much money? And so there really have been a lot of changes to the way that presidential primaries have been financed in the last, certainly in the last 40 years during my lifetime, but also in the last 20 years since the public financing system collapsed. And so I want to sort of highlight that there really have been some significant changes in the amount of spending, and that partly is due to the collapse of the public financing system. But also, I ask a couple of questions in the chapter. You know, why is it that campaigns have to raise so much money? I do a literature review to show that it's, you know, it's partly about building familiarity and name recognition. It's partly because of the front-loaded cycle. It's partly because of competition. And Steve Forbes's, competition in 1996 encourage George W. Bush to back out of the public financing system. And that's a really important part. That competition is a really important part of the story. You have to be afraid of a billionaire running against you, and so raise as much money as possible. And the professionalization is another part of that. And then I think the other part of the story that students are always interested in is, does money actually buy the nomination? And certainly with my students, we were closely watching, you know, how when we were all together this semester, the Bloomberg campaign, and asking, okay, so is this a good test? Can money buy the nomination if you throw an unlimited amount of money at it? And what I talked about in the chapter is that the literature doesn't seem to indicate that that's the case, that it's that the parties have a role to play, that endorsements play a role, that pre-existing name recognition plays a really important role, and polls play a really, you know, as reflected in polls, in giving someone the nomination, and that fundraising is probably more an indicator of a candidate's strength than a determinant of the outcome. And that a candidate would raise from the party network might be the best indicator. And I think we probably saw an example of that sort of party decides kind of model with the Biden nomination. So those were the topics that I talked about, and I tried to frame it in terms of questions that students would be interested in.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And Jonathan, you talk about the expanded party's influence, which of course also then makes us think about who's in the party, how the parties operate, and if they are coherent wholes or not.
Yes. And, you know, the sort of background to this is the longstanding question of, since the McGovern-Fraser reforms before the 1972 cycle, of who actually makes the nomination? Is it the parties as it was before 1972, or is it, as Nelson Polsby thought, reacting to the McGovern nomination, Jimmy Carter nomination, is it sort of a random slash media effect that, well, whoever gets, you know, that political primaries by their nature are sort of open to all kinds of influences, because voters, you know, don't really know the difference between 25 different candidates, as there were for Democrats in 2020, or 16 or 17, whatever it was, candidates as there were for Republicans. And so there can be really random effects. So that's, you know, there's sort of the Polsby point of view. And then there's the other point of view, which is that parties successfully learned after the 1970s to control nominations, and that part of the way to think about that is to think of parties not just as the formal party organizations, the, you know, the RNC and the DNC and the, you know, Michigan State Party or the Cook County Democratic Party, but as a combination of formal party organizations and informal networks, which is what I call the expanded party. And so I had been saying for some time that the, you know, along with the authors of the party sides, that, and Casey and some other people, that we think that parties played a strong role in nominations. And, you know, that had looked pretty good for several cycles, and it looks good for Hillary Clinton in 2016 on the Democratic side, but it looks very, very bad for them in 2016. So the question is, okay, what happened? Were we wrong all along, or has the system changed so that parties no longer control things? Or was Polsby right all the time? And, you know, there was a certain randomness to it. So what I looked at is, okay, so why does Trump win despite clearly not being the candidate of the party, no matter really how you define the party? So what I wound up thinking is there's sort of three elements to this. One is having to do with the Republican Party itself as it exists now, and saying that following, you know, Norm Ornstein, Tom Mann, and some others talking about how dysfunctional the Republican Party is. So that, for example, one of the key elements of this was that right before the Iowa caucuses in 2016, Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, gets the endorsement of the organized Christian conservative movement, despite the fact that Cruz was really no better for them than half a dozen of the other candidates. But he had the disadvantage that most of the rest of the party really hated Ted Cruz. And so, you know, in a more functional party, the different factions would have found a way to work together. And in this case, they really didn't. So part one, functional Republican Party. Part two goes back to something that actually Nelson Polsby said at one point in consequence of party reform, which is that stability is good for parties. Stability in rules and procedures is good for parties. Changes are bad for parties. So I looked at sort of some of the real changes to the procedure in 2016 and found two in particular that seemed important. One was the demise, the absence of the Ames straw poll, which Bill Mayer talks about in his chapter about straw polls and the end of straw polls as a important point. And the question of whether, well, had there been an Ames straw poll in August of 2015, how would that have changed the process? And I think that wound up helping Trump in various different ways. Second way that I talked about was changes in media norms, in particular, CNN, and then a lot of other media outlets following CNN decided to cover, had in previous years, they had followed what Don Sides and Lynn Vavreck talk about as, and now I'm going to forget the words for it. Discovery. Of candidates so that candidates would get discovered by the media, they'd hype them, and then they'd do scrutiny. And so then they'd move on to the next story. So candidates would surge up in the polls, then get critical coverage, and then the media would move on to another story. What happened in 2015, 2016, and the 4 years since then, is that the CNN in particular and the other media also discovered that Donald Trump was a great story and they could make Donald Trump into a story that continued over and over and over again. And I talk in the piece about how that's somewhat similar to how CNN discovered the missing Malaysian airplane as a continuing story that even though that it wasn't actually generating any news, they could keep it as they could make it into news just because they said it was news. And that sort of is what happened with Donald Trump in lots of sort of institutional ways. So because the norms and procedure changed, that turned out to make it more difficult for the party to come together. And then the third thing was just a bunch of dumb luck that, you know, when Marco Rubio was about to surge into control, he had one of the worst debate performances of any major candidate ever, that John Kasich acted weird through the campaign and did things like not entering primaries despite having a chance to win. But he stayed in the race anyway. And no candidate really has behaved like that because the incentives are that you have to enter all the primaries. He was acting like sort of a 1950s candidate who could pick and choose which primaries to go into. So all of those things wind up essentially defeating the party and giving us Donald Trump. And my argument is basically, well, the parties are pretty strong, but there's a lot of contingency and incomplete control, which sort of matches the parties themselves, which are non-hierarchical and loosely structured. So it's not about the specific procedures that you can fix by procedural reforms, as it is about sort of the nature of the parties, that they're never going to be completely able to control things. And, you know, as it turns out, that gives us Donald Trump in 2016.
And so a lot of the chapters, as you note, as you talked about half the book are devoted to sort of thinking about the role of the parties in relation to the nomination in some form or fashion. So I wanted to ask a little bit about the question of straw polls, as you just mentioned, Jonathan, as well as, you know, some of the rule changes that transpired that are in chapters 5 and 6 by Josh Putnam and William Mayer.
Casey, you want to take a crack at it, or I just talked for a long time?
Oh, sure. So chapter 6 is, I think what we've all decided is the definitive history of straw polls and their role in the nomination process by Bill Mayer. And so he goes through the sort of the rise of the straw poll as something that the media gets fixated on, and the demise of the straw poll as the media in the early 2000s realizes that actually they're not representative and they really ought to be relying on actual polls, which there were enough of, later on that you didn't have to rely on these straw polls, but that they were a way of trying to gauge the status of candidates in the invisible primary. But that as better measures came about, they were replaced. It's interesting to actually sort of watch the history of an institution that kind of came on the scene. People realized it wasn't really that great of an institution, and it died.
And Putnam's is about, again, sort of the nomination rules. And they sort of shift and change, as you note, Jonathan, and as a lot of the sort of discussion keeps discussing, or a lot of the public discussion keeps going on about how people are feeling about the rule changes. And so Putnam talks about how the 2016 affected the 2020 race, and how that we've talked about in the past in political science, how 2012 affected the 2016 race. So the presidential nomination rules seem to come up as something that often shapes the next iteration.
I was going to say, if we had decided to write an introduction, which we ultimately decided not to do, I think the fluidity and how just the amount of change in the presidential nomination process, it is this ever evolving thing, just from the beginning of the Republic all the way through today. And I think Putnam's chapter does a really great job. He gets into the nitty gritty, he is the expert on following all of the nitty gritty rules changes in the DNC and the RNC, and all the state primary rules. He is the go-to person in political science, as far as we can tell. And he lays out the minute details of the conversations. Why is it that certain rules changes were made by the Republicans in 2012 in response to their loss in 2008? But that, once the party wins with a certain set of rules, they keep those rules. And then when they lose with a certain set of rules, then they tweak those rules. And so, this year the Democrats have the tweaks that were brought about by the Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton campaigns, sort of negotiating after the election about how the rules would look for 2020, because they lost in 2016. But in 2016, the Democrats were dealing with, hey, the rules had, we won the Obama won in 2012, so there's no reason to change those rules. So he gets into the very fine points of how the party nomination process is always evolving. But I think that from the very first chapter about women emerging as serious contenders for the presidency, all the way to the last chapter about how King Caucus sort of came about and then left the scene in the early 1800s. Change is definitely the name of the game in the presidential nomination process.
And one of the things that I think the ways that sort of this stuff goes together is when you think about, the changes in procedures with the straw polls and the rules, changes in who the candidates are, changes in how resources are raised and used. And then you think about where and how the media works, and then you think about the voter chapter, Sides and Tesler and Vavrick, about how contingent everything is, that we don't, parties are not fixed the way that general elections are. We have, people who have party IDs, so they pretty much are predictable. There's so much unpredictable, so you can have things like, as we saw this time, it turned out that the key to Joe Biden winning the nomination probably was that he finished second in Nevada, a few points ahead of a couple other candidates, while Bernie Sanders won easily. But because Biden did that, he managed to emerge as the alternative to Bernie and then got endorsements and did well in South Carolina. And, thinking through how that works depends a lot on all those ingredients before it, who the candidates are, what kinds of people are allowed to be candidates and how they're allowed to be candidates, which is sort of what the first chapter of the volume is about, and how the rules are arranged that we have these four carve out states that come at the beginning that are fairly on a fairly stable schedule now, as Josh Putnam talks about, et cetera, through the process. So, and then how that, implicates parties in what actually happens and how parties have to deal with all of these changes and uncertainties while parties themselves are changing and uncertain institutions.
And so I guess one of my sort of remaining questions is, given what we've seen in terms of the process in 2020, and all of the uncertainty that this process kind of has embedded in it, oddly enough. It's a certain process with lots of uncertainty. What do you both anticipate may be some of the changes we'll see in 4 years' time?
I think there you go back to what Josh Putnam says, the winners tend to be conservative in their changes, the losers tend to change a lot. If Joe Biden wins, Democrats will probably keep their procedures the same. Of course, this could be a possibility of a one-term president who might not run for a second term. People are talking about that. I don't know how likely it is. If he's running for a second term, then you would really expect not much institutional change because the nomination won't be presumably very contested. On the Republican side, we will have a contested nomination next time around. If Trump wins, he's going to determine what the procedures will be. If he loses, we're going to have a lot of very difficult to predict outcomes in terms of where the Republican Party goes from there. And I'm not going to even guess at what they do institutionally or in any other way.
Casey, anything to add?
No, I think that I think that was a what I would say.
I'm looking for somebody to tell me like Iowa is or isn't going to be first up after sort of the debacle that was a lot of Iowa.
Such a good question. I think the Democrats have been moving toward more inclusion, and the caucuses are a pretty exclusive institution. So it's a tradition versus this trend toward inclusion in the Democratic Party. And I don't think we know when they're going to resolve that in favor of not having the Iowa caucuses. But the trend seems to mediate against it, I would say.
Yeah, I think, if Biden wins the presidency, of course, he was somebody who was, at least on the surface, not helped by Iowa this time. So he has no stake in keeping it there. He's got clobbered through twice in Iowa over the years. But it turns out that moving it has a lot of costs, and it's not clear that there are definite benefits, especially in the short term. So I think it's going to turn out to be a lot harder to replace Iowa than it looked, back in February this year. What we have seen is that the procedures changed this year and they botched actually carrying it out. So I think that we would see more successful procedures in Iowa if it was to go first the next time. And they might be on, they might get one more chance, but make sure you don't botch it again, as a guess. But it's not as easy to remove Iowa as it looks.
I understand that. It just seemed an interesting evening and proceeding. And the week that followed, as we moved to New Hampshire.
I would just say that the lesson from Iowa is that the news media does not deal well with not receiving election returns exactly when it says on their nightly news schedule, exactly on their timetable that they're going to get them, and that bodes poorly for this November. Never mind.
Very much so. Yeah.
And so I wanted to ask each of you, now that you have a book on the 2020 nomination, what you are each respectively working on now.
I'm writing columns.
I know.
I'm considering whether I want to write an essay about the Biden nomination, which I do have a few things to say about it, so I might do so.
Okay. Casey?
I have been working for a long time on a book manuscript that I am revising about the evolution of presidential war powers. And I am continuing to revise that manuscript.
Got it. So when the manuscript is done and the book is out, will you come and speak with me about it on the New Books Network again?
I would be delighted. Thank you for asking.
Excellent. I assume that The Making of the Presidential Candidates 2020 is available at Roman and Littlefield website for purchase. So today I was joined by Jonathan Bernstein and Casey Dominguez, who are the editors of The Making of the Presidential Candidates 2020. This book was published in the fall of 2019 by Roman and Littlefield. It's available at Roman and Littlefield's website and any place else where you purchase books. And I'd like to thank Casey and Jonathan for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.